The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I guess they're off and running at Philadelphia Youth Camp in Edmond, Oklahoma. Today is the first day of camp activities, I believe. And we've got ours here at Edstone, I think about 2 weeks from now. And we met together with the fellows that are going to be serving at camp, talked about their positions of responsibility last night. Talked about the subject of leadership, looked at the example, once again, of Winston Churchill following the last two programs that we've had this week, yesterday's and the one on Monday. We're going to be talking later on today's show about educating Winston Churchill. How did a failure at school, that's what he was, how did he become one of the most learned statesmen in history? I mean, you would have to search far and wide to find a statesman more educated, with more education and wisdom and understanding than Winston Churchill. And yet the man, as a youth anyway, he was dreadful when it came to taking tests. He tried three times to get into Sandhurst, and he kept failing, and the third time he just barely made it in. How did he turn into the statesman that we now know him to be? That's coming up on the next segment. But first, the news. President Trump, he's in Europe right now for meetings with America's NATO allies. And I guess you could say it got off to a fiery start. This morning, he attended a breakfast with the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg. And this, I think, technically happened before some of the other world leaders arrived, so the summit hadn't properly begun yet. But here he is at breakfast, and I mean, he laid it into Germany and then tweeted about it. He tweeted out this 2-minute video for all of his millions of followers to see. Here's a sampling, clip one.
Germany makes a massive oil and gas deal with Russia where you're supposed to be guarding against Russia, and Germany goes out and pays billions and billions of dollars a year to Russia. So we're protecting Germany, we're protecting France, we're protecting all of these countries, and then numerous of the countries go out and make a pipeline deal with Russia where they're paying billions of dollars into the coffers of Russia. So we're supposed to protect you against Russia, but they're paying billions of dollars to Russia, and I think that's very inappropriate. And the former chancellor of Germany is the head of the pipeline company that's supplying the gas. Ultimately, Germany will have almost 70% of their country controlled by Russia with natural gas. So you tell me, is that appropriate? I mean, I've been complaining about this from the time I got in. It should have never been allowed to have happened. But Germany is totally controlled by Russia because they will be getting from 60 to 70% of their energy from Russia and a new pipeline. And you tell me if that's appropriate, because I think it's not. And I think it's a very bad thing for NATO, and I don't think it should have happened. And I think we have to talk to Germany about it.
Wow. I mean, that's the United States president talking to European leaders, quite unlike any other president, at least in our modern days. Very direct and forthright, very critical, talking about Germany cozying up to Russia. I mean, he's laying it into to Germany and Russia, the nation he supposedly colluded with to get into office. Now, again, we want to always look at these events with the clear light of Bible prophecy shining upon them. Soon after Mr. Trump was elected, here again, everyone's talking about Russian collusion. And we wrote at the Trumpet about the Russian alliance that you really need to worry about. This is what we had to say. America may draw close to Russia, but no close alliance is possible. It's not even possible. Instead, there's another alliance coming that would that the world should really pay attention to, it says. This is at the Trumpet. Russia and Germany have much to gain by working together. Historically, Russia could only dominate Eastern Europe when European powers were weak or when they acquiesced. So that's the alliance. That's the partnership that we want to be looking for. And this, in many ways, is what President Trump is exposing. He's saying, look, okay, let's talk about NATO. I mean, this is something that's basically funded and it's driven by the United States, by American power. And okay, we're here to supposedly protect you and the Eastern European nations from Russia. And then you have Germany, the economic powerhouse of Europe, entering into this massive oil deal, this gas deal with Russia, paying billions and billions of dollars to Russia. And we're supposed to protect you against Russia? That's the president of the United States and dropping a truth bomb on the NATO reps. And he's got meetings later, I understand, with the chancellor of Germany. We'll see how that goes. Well, this article at the Trumpet, it talks about some important history just from the last two centuries. What has happened when Germany draws near to Russia? It happened in the late 1700s. I didn't get the author on this Trumpet article. I presume it's Richard Palmer. But then it talks about the more recent history. World War II, of course, you're very familiar with the infamous Hitler-Stalin Pact, also known as the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which carved up Poland, handed part of it to Russia. Germany got the rest. And so what is the significance? When we look at it today, here comes another temporary alliance between these two. Of course, in World War II, you know that eventually it led to an explosion of world war. Listen to this. This is from that same article. It says, in May 1962, The Plain Truth, predecessor of the Trumpet, wrote, once a German-dominated Europe is fully established, Germany will be ready to negotiate and bargain with Russia and behind the backs of the Western allies if necessary. So they've gained dominance. I mean, there's no question. Germany's in control in Europe. And now here they are negotiating, bargaining with Russia behind the backs of Western allies. And Donald Trump shows up this morning and says, look, there's this billions dollars worth of dealing going on between Germany and Russia. It's inappropriate. Our article brought this out. Well, it's quoting from that 1962 Plain Truth. It says, when a Russo-German deal is made, you can be sure that the doom of the United States and Great Britain is on the horizon. And then the Trumpet writes, sound far-fetched? Eminent scholars in the field of international relations made the same warning to Hans Morgenthau. Such a deal would be a drastic change in the distribution of world power. This is all at thetrumpet.com. Donald Trump's right about Germany. Germany working behind the scenes with this deal, with Russia building this pipeline together. You look at all of these close connections. I mean, this is the collusion that's really prophetically significant. Germany's the one that we need to be paying attention to. Here's a little bit more from this morning's breakfast. Donald Trump and the NATO security general and their respective staffs as well. Clip two.
But on top of that, Germany is just paying a little bit over 1%. Whereas the United States, in actual numbers, is paying 4.2% of a much larger GDP. So I think that's inappropriate also. You know, we're protecting Germany, we're protecting France, we're protecting everybody, and yet we're paying a lot of money to protect. Now, this has been going on for decades. This has been brought up by other presidents, but other presidents never did anything about it because I don't think they understood it or they just didn't want to get involved. But I have to bring it up because I think it's very unfair to our country. It's very unfair to our taxpayer.
Well, here again, America is spending a huge amount of money defending Europe with this NATO alliance. Europe doesn't have to spend, not only does Europe not have to spend money to defend itself, it doesn't even have to, I'll read this article to you in just a moment, it doesn't even have to really concern itself with defense or geopolitical strategy. It's all been taken care of for decades following World War II. You go all the way back to 1952, this would have just been six, 7 years after the war. And here's Herbert Armstrong. Here's what he had to say. Yet in spending unprecedented billions of your dollars and mine, tax dollars, Mr. Armstrong said, preparing Germany and Europe for defense against the war that isn't going to come, the war with Russia, that is. He said it's not going to come. Mr. Armstrong says, stupid, bungling America is spending its wealth and resources to produce the Frankenstein that is going to turn on us in an offensive war of invasion and destroy our United States. That's the real news of today and tomorrow, he said. That's the news that ought to stagger us. I mean, this is the news that Donald Trump is unaware of, but he's definitely onto something. He's coming over there, or coming right here to Europe, saying, look, we're spending billions of dollars, billions of U.S. tax dollars, preparing Germany, protecting Germany, protecting Europe from a war with Russia that's not going to come. It's not going to happen. The coming war is between the European Union, or the United States of Europe, and America and Britain. That's the news that ought to stagger us. That's the news, as Mr. Armstrong said, that ought to rouse us out of complacency. That's the news that ought to startle us into action. That's the news, that's the truth. Here's America, after all of these decades, paying for Europe's defense, essentially, pouring all of this money into Europe, into Germany, so that Germany could just focus in on rebuilding its economic might and power. And it's certainly done that. President Trump's there this morning saying, look, Germany's a wealthy nation now, a prosperous nation. And they're only paying 1%. And we're paying 4.2%. And we have a much bigger GDP. Here's the final statement that we have from that tweet that the president sent out, clip 3.
I think that these countries have to step it up, not over a 10-year period, they have to step it up immediately. Germany is a rich country. They talk about they're going to increase it a tiny bit by 2030. Well, they could increase it immediately tomorrow and have no problem. I don't think it's fair to the United States. So we're going to have to do something because we're not going to put up with it. We can't put up with it, and it's inappropriate.
Do you suppose this might accelerate a number of Bible prophecies that I think most of you are aware of? Germany says they'll make the changes. They say they'll increase defense spending by 2025 or 2030. And here's the President of the United States saying they can do it today. They can do it right now. Germany's a rich country. Other presidents of the United States in years past, I mean, they've acknowledged this problem, but they haven't done anything about it. I'm here to tell you, we're going to do something about it. Well, you have to give the president at least credit for seeing a problem. But what effect will his solution have on Germany and the rest of Europe? This is the United States basically leaving the scene after Europe has been rebuilt, after the superpower is in place, after Germany has emerged as the dominant power in Europe. And now, I mean, they are getting the incentive they need, Germany, that is, to rebuild a military, to become a military force, in addition to being the economic force that it is. Here again, let's refer you back to the literature, The trumpet, the plain truth before the trumpet came along. This is the plain truth from the 1980s. It says the current generation also overlooks the fact that without NATO, the age-old German question in the heart of Europe would rise once again to the surface. I mean, NATO's kept it suppressed. NATO has served its purpose. It's not just to protect Germany from Russia. It's to suppress Germany. This is what the president doesn't see, of course. It says West German sovereignty is uniquely limited. Upon joining NATO, the West Germans renounced having their own national army, instead placing the Bundeswehr under NATO, meaning ultimately under U.S. command. The Bonn government, this is when Bonn was the capital, the Bonn government also forswore production and ownership of atomic weapons in return for protection under America's nuclear umbrella. To tamper with this arrangement is to open a potential Pandora's box. See, Donald Trump sees the unfairness. He sees that the United States can't continue on funding all of these operations around the world. What he doesn't see is that to tamper with this arrangement is to open a potential Pandora's box. Okay, you fix it, you make it equal, you make everyone pay their fair share, and then you remove the American nuclear umbrella, and what are you left with? What does history teach us? Where is this headed? I mean, if Germany's no longer under U.S. command, what does that mean? Germany pushing to rearm is not something that's going to bring peace to this world. Carnegie Europe, in an article last Friday, it headlined it, Trump may be doing the EU and NATO a big favor. It says here, yet the general outpourings of angst and indignation about the fate of the transatlantic community are obscuring an intriguing possibility that the Trump phenomenon could actually prove to be good for the European Union and NATO. Both organizations have long acknowledged their own need for substantive reform and then essentially waited for someone else to goad them into action. Despite his own destructive tendencies, this is Carnegie writing about Trump, keep in mind, he may well prove to be the catalyst that they need. Well, they're right about that. It says, until Trump came on the scene, neither organization had to think or act strategically. The transatlantic relationship was taken for granted, as was the international rulebook. But now Trump is pushing European elites out of their comfort zone, forcing them to think through their security, defense, and foreign policies. You add to all of this the President Trump's threats of tariffs and trade war, and how Europe is already taking action, as I covered with you yesterday, to respond to this. The article continued, the goal that our armed forces learn to get to know each other and act together. Well, that's actually another article that's talking about, again, Europe. And I read through the piece yesterday that talked about them, the leaders in Europe, wanting to facilitate easier access or movement for European armies in those EU nations. A few months ago, Spiegel wrote, lately, the American president has emerged as a great unifier of Europe. See, Pandora's box is being opened. And these prophecies of a united Europe, a United States of Europe, they're accelerating now because of what we see happening in this transatlantic alliance, this relationship. Here you have a United States president now. He's coming in there boldly and speaking to them directly across the breakfast table, across this conference room table, telling them, look, we've had it. We're not going to support you any longer, or at least we're not going to dominate this arrangement. You're going to have to carry your fair share. We wrote in the last Trumpet edition, Europe and America losing that loving feeling And that article drew attention to some of the headlines, some of the cover stories at Spiegel. This is the most popular magazine in Germany, Europe's largest news magazine. And it seems like it's almost every other week where it's portraying the United States president as some kind of crazed lunatic, a terrorist beheading a Statue of Liberty, portraying Donald Trump as some kind of subhuman ape, or as a baby riding a nuclear bomb. He's going to blow up the world. You see, Trump's the problem, they say. Well, he's visiting Europe now. He's supposed to come to Britain here in a couple of days. And, of course, there were those headlines a few days ago about this this float in London, the baby Trump blimp, I guess it's called, just to mock the president. Even in Britain, he's mocked by the mayor of London. And yet, when you keep coming back to these prophecies, my father wrote a piece in 2014, The Significance of Germany's Break from America. What is the significance of this? I mean, my father's writing that back in 2014. That was in the Obama administration. But that relationship was unraveling. It was beginning to unravel. You remember some of the scandals then, spying on Chancellor Merkel. President Obama was well known for that. The relationship was in trouble then. But now look at where it is today. And then consider all of the prophecies about America and Britain, for that matter, being betrayed by our lovers. Jeremiah 30 and verse 14, all of your lovers have forgotten you. They seek you not. You think they're going to try to do the United States any favors in return? After all of these decades of propping up this alliance to protect Europe, to suppress Germany, when Germany fully emerges as a superpower, do you think they're going to try to return the favor to the United States? Not if Spiegel has anything to say about it. Of course, we know about the prophecies regarding the strong man. What about that one? Do you think the strong man's just itching to act? Do you think he's beginning to experience the mind change? These are sobering prophecies. These are sobering events. I mean, prophecy is accelerating. There's another verse, Ezekiel 16 and verse 33, it says, they give gifts to all whores, it says, but you give your gifts to all your lovers and hire them that they may come unto you on every side for your whoredom. See, eventually, this adulterous relationship, it's going to end. It's going to end in a bitter struggle, a bitter fight. God says, I'll gather all your lovers with whom you have taken pleasure, I will even gather them round about against you. Against you. You see, God's problem ultimately with the United States and the Trump administration and all of his foreign policy advisors, for all of the might that they're showing, for all of the flexing that's going on, they're not looking to God for protection. They're not looking to God for the solution. As my father has said before, you see, this president, he does do a pretty good job of identifying problems, injustices. He does a pretty good job of confronting them even. But what about the solutions? What are the solutions? And what happens when you open Pandora's box in Germany? Here we are, the United States of America, the nation that's most responsible, far and above any other nation, for rebuilding a European empire led by Germany, economically for sure, and now you look at the direction that Europe is about to head in, building up its defense. Pandora's box has been opened. That's for sure. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we're going to look at the subject of educating Winston Churchill. How did a failure at school become one of the most learned statesmen in history? We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
During his lecture at Philadelphia Youth Camp last year, my father challenged our teenaged children to learn more about World War II, specifically about the outstanding wartime leadership of Winston Churchill. And as I brought out yesterday, my father also encouraged our young people to study William Manchester's biography on Churchill, The Last Lion. Manchester's work, my father said, has a greater sense of drama than many of the other biographies on the same subject. And he understood, Manchester did, he understood and emphasized the momentous impact Churchill had on Western civilization. Winston Churchill was the greatest statesman of the 20th century. Now, how did that happen? No one would have picked Winston as a potential savior of Western civilization when he was a young boy. Certainly not. He was a miserable failure at boarding school and the dysfunctional household that he grew up in. It made him unhappy. He was terribly lonely. His self-absorbed father never loved him. I mean, you could read through Manchester's books and make a case that he hated his son. And then there was his pleasure-seeking mother, the adulteress. And she only showed interest in Winston as an adult, a young adult, because that's when he began to become interesting, she said. And so she finally took an interest. It's interesting, as I say, when he tried and tried and tried again to get into Sandhurst. I think he was 18 at the time he finally got in. That's Britain's military academy. And he did that on the third time after hiring a crammer to help him study. And as I say, even still, he barely made it in. His marks were so low that, they were high enough to barely get in, but they were too low to be admitted as an infantry cadet. So Sandhurst just accepted him into the cavalry, but even still, I mean, Churchill was just ecstatic. He wrote to his father, "I was so glad to be able to send you the good news. I'm so happy. I made it in. I'm going to Sandhurst. I'm going to be something. I'm going to be someone who's successful, who's capable, who's educated, And his father responded to him with something that was just extraordinarily cruel. Lord Randolph said, "Never have I received a really good report of your conduct in your work from any master or tutor." And then later on, his dad said, "Do not think I'm going to take the trouble of writing to you long letters after every failure you commit and undergo. Don't think I'm going to write you. You've just made one failure after another." He wasn't finished. Winston, he said, had led an idle, useless, unprofitable life. He said that if Winston didn't turn it around, that he would become a mere social wastrel, one of hundreds of public school failures. He said he would degenerate into a shabby, unhappy, and futile existence. Well, young Winston was understandably devastated by his father's harsh condemnation. He said, "I'm very sorry indeed that you are displeased with me." And he went on to say that he would work really hard at Sandhurst, and that hopefully, his father would modify his opinion of young Winston. Well, his father didn't live long enough to ever modify his opinion. And young Winston, on the other hand, I mean, it wasn't that way. It didn't go both ways, this animosity. Winston revered his dad. He devoted 3 years of his life to writing a glowing 2-volume biography about his father, Lord Randolph. He honored his father, this non-existent father, who shipped little Winston to boarding school when he was 7 years old, and then carefully avoided his son for the rest of his life. Manchester notes in his biography, he said, "Seldom has a man invested so little affection in a son and reaped such dividends of posthumous loyalty." He loved his father, even though that love, it didn't come back, or it wasn't returned. His parents, as I say, they neglected their son, their unique son, and I guess if there is any defense in the way that his father reacted, or any defense of Lord Randolph, it is true that Winston was a troubled child at school. A lot of that was crying out for attention, attention he didn't get at home. But his parents neglected him, and as my father said at the youth camp last summer, God the Father did not neglect him. As he said to those young people last year, God sent Elizabeth Everest to look after Winston during his childhood. Elizabeth Everest, she's the affectionate nanny who tended to all of Winston's needs. And the significance of her role in young Winston's upbringing, it can't be overemphasized. She's basically the only person in Winston's childhood who loved him unconditionally. She died when Winston was 20 years old. And Churchill said, "She lived such an innocent and loving life of service to others." It was the 20-year-old Winston Churchill who took charge of the funeral arrangements for Mrs. Everest, a woman he called Womb. That was his affectionate nickname for her. Manchester writes, "Except for his hours in the nursery with Womb, his early years had brought him very little pleasure and much pain, but they fashioned him into a strong young man, possessed of immense drive, ready to mount the steep slopes of challenge ahead." At the youth camp last year, my father told the teens that if God can intervene in the life of a young boy, if God can intervene to work with a difficult, unhappy youngster and then later use him to save the Western world, Think about what he can do with you. Think about how much God can do with you. God can and will make you great if you look to him as your ruler and educator. And if you're really hungry for wisdom and understanding, and Winston, as he grew older, he struggled in the classroom, but he got hungrier and hungrier for knowledge, for truth. He was terrible at taking tests, as I said. But as a teenager, he fell in love with books. He would fail the tests, but then he could recite 1,200 lines of Macaulay, the historian from the mid-1800s. When he was at Harrow, before he went off to Sandhurst, he frequented a bookshop across the way, across the road, and fell in love with history. And he also developed what would be a lifelong fascination with words, the English language. I got it into my bones, it says in Manchester's biography. The essential structure of the ordinary British sentence. This is quoting Churchill. It's a noble thing, he said. And when in after years my schoolfellows, who had won prizes and distinction for writing such beautiful Latin poetry and pithy Greek epigrams, had to come down again to common English to earn their living or make their way, Churchill said, I did not feel myself at any disadvantage. He hated Latin and Greek, and all the other bright students were immersed into that. Churchill, on the other hand, immersed himself into English. And he really became hungry, as I said, for truth, for knowledge, for wisdom, understanding. He became a lover of history, as I discussed yesterday. Jesus said in Matthew 5 and verse 6, of course, this is talking about hungering for the truth of God, but it says here, blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. And you can apply this to education more generally. If you hunger and thirst for knowledge and understanding, you can be filled. It's amazing how satisfied you can be if you really are hungry for learning. Manchester said, Winston was being taught to teach himself. He would always be a dud in the classroom and a failure in examinations, but in his own time, on his own terms, he would become one of the most learned statesmen of the coming century. He was pretty much self-taught. So you had all of this neglect and dysfunction at his home, his household. But there was love and affection coming from just one person, Mrs. Everest. And then there was also this burning passion that he had to read and to study. There was a teacher at Harrow that saw that for all of his weaknesses, there were some pretty amazing strengths. Mr. Somerville, I believe, was his name. He knew that this young man had some potential because of his love for history, because of his love of language. He was a dud in the classroom, but he really pored over the books. It reminds me of what Mr. Armstrong said in the autobiography, his own autobiography. He said, education comes from study, from books, from lectures, from contacts, from travel, from thinking about what you see and hear and read, and from experience. And then notice this statement. He said, the reason we have to maintain schools and universities is simply that most people are too lazy, most lack the ambition and persistence, the drive, to procure an education outside of schools and colleges. I was telling some of our young men on campus last night that it's a tremendous blessing to have the college. And when school is in session, there's a lot of structure there. You've got people over you cracking the whip saying, this is what needs to be done. This is what you need to read. Here's what you need to study. But what about when school's out of session? How disciplined and driven are you to really go after God's knowledge, to really go after history and to love it? How hungry are you? How much do you hunger and thirst for God's truth? Or in the case of this remarkable example, for the truth that you can find in Manchester's two volumes, there's three, I guess, the third one he had help with. But this is all a part of your lifetime of education. Education never stops. Salvation is education. You look at the way Churchill, or to follow on with this example of Mr. Armstrong, you look at the way these men, as young men, were educated. Mr. Armstrong never had any formal schooling either. I mean, Churchill had more schooling than he did. But as you can read in the autobiography, you can see how the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin impacted Mr. Armstrong. Multiple readings. He talks about the autobiography of Bernard Baruch, biographies about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and many others, he says. And he talks about how that the New Testament, the Apostle Paul's writings, the Gospel books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Old Testament, I mean, it's replete with all of these biographical sketches, all of these life experiences. And the teachings, in the case of the Gospels, the experiences and the teachings of Jesus Christ. It's right there in the Bible. Well, you look at the full life that Mr. Armstrong had. He studied his Bible. There's no doubt about that. But then look at what he did. What a man of action. And it's the same with Winston Churchill. He went off to Sandhurst, and he became, I think, the second best horse rider there. He loved polo. He was into fencing. He was obviously adventurous. He was in the army. He was on location with so many of these battles in India and Egypt and South Africa. It's interesting, too, when he went off to India on assignment, his afternoon and evening activities, I think, were pretty well set. And the rest of the guys would just kind of goof off and play sports for 4 and 5 hours of the day when they had free time. And Churchill decided that, I don't know much. I mean, he had gone through Harrow, he had gone through Sandhurst, and now he's off in the military, and he went in, he said, pretty ignorant. And so while he was in India, he set goals for himself, reading goals every day, 50 pages of Macaulay and 25 pages of Gibbon. It's not the easiest reading, certainly not by today's standards. But he felt like that without this, he would just stagnate when it comes to education and learning and growing. 50 pages of Macaulay, 25 pages of Gibbon, and he did this over the course of 3 or 4 years, Manchester says he had entered the army an ignorant youth, and now, less than 4 years later, his command of English distinguished him from every other correspondent in the field and won admiration of readers accustomed to the finest Victorian prose. I mean, this is how he became such an effective writer, because he was such a diligent reader and studier. Manchester says his university continued to be his books, and he could now read at great speed, and his writing had become his livelihood. If you know the story, he got a few years into the military life and realized that he wasn't really going to be able to make much of his life until he got out and made a really good living, and so he started to write. Reading and writing. And this was the beginning. This was Churchill in his early 20s. No love from his mom and dad. His dad died when he was 20. His nanny a few months later after that. And then he's pretty much off on his own. He got some discipline and structure at Sandhurst finally. And then really started to take off. And a lot of it was because of these 4 years. He had entered the army an ignorant youth. And now, less than 4 years later, this is all on his own, mind you. This is not in the helpful environment of a disciplined college setting. This was on his own, self-taught. He came away 4 years later with the command of the English language, a respected correspondent in the field, admired by readers from all over the world. And that's because his university, it was his books. Look at what the Apostle Paul said to Timothy. I think I was intending to get to this verse yesterday. I didn't quite have time at the end of the show. But in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 12, it says, "Let no man despise your youth, but be you an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity." Whether it's your speech, your conduct, whatever it is, you're a young man, you're a young minister. A lot of the brethren are older than you, but set an example. Just set an example in your conduct, in the way that you live. And then in verse 13, it says, "Till I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Until I come, you make sure that you really give proper attention to reading." I mean, you're going to be on your own, Timothy. You're not going to some bigwig university here, but you are going to have to study on your own. Pay attention to this. My father's talked before about, this is in Malachi's message, about the approach to Bible study and how that it reveals how noble we are. There really is a connection here. I was telling the fellows that last night. If you're not good at reading, if you're not interested in reading, how can that not impact your Bible study, something that we need to be doing every day? Of course, that's at the top of the list. You talk about 50 pages of this and 25 pages of that. Right at the top, and this is where Churchill obviously didn't have his mind open to the truth. Mr. Armstrong did. Mr. Armstrong had the priorities right. He had the Bible study first. Certainly he did when God opened his mind in 1926. But he had all the other readings too. And that was one of the things that aggravated him when his, as I said the other day, when his relative came along and said he was ignorant. He knew he had been plowing through the books. But he accepted the challenge from, I think it was his sister-in-law, and then from his wife on the Sabbath, and he started to really dig in and study. And this is the point that I made yesterday with respect to history. That the more we dig in and study the history, the more that we're going to love it. And as I said yesterday, it needs to be a family affair. This is something that David McCullough brought out in some of those clips I played for you. Going back to 1993, going back to 2005, I think it was. And then here he is just last year. And again, he's echoing some of the same things, some of the same warnings that he's been proclaiming for decades now. Here's clip four.
I began to think about the great presidents down the years who have been avid readers of history. Many of them wrote history, including John Kennedy. And even those who didn't have the benefit of a college education like Harry Truman read history all their lives and realized that it's essential to the role of a leader, whether it's the presidency or leadership of any kind, about cause and effect. History matters. If I have one message that I would like to get across in my work and in gatherings like this, is history matters a lot. And we're slipping in our responsibility of teaching history to our children and grandchildren. It's been going on a good long time.
That's a much older David McCullough than what you heard yesterday. And here he is still, as I say, still proclaiming the same urgent message. We're slipping in our responsibility to teach history to our children, to our grandchildren. And it's been going on for so long. And you need to know, and our children need to know, that history matters. And that history and awareness and understanding of history is essential to the role of a leader. Whether it's the presidency of the United States or leadership of any kind. Now you go to that royal vision that I mentioned yesterday, the seven keys to building leadership. And my father using the example of Churchill and Manchester and history around World War II and the leadership of Churchill and as it compares to the way Hitler operated. He said, how much do you young people understand or know about that history? History matters. And as Mr. McCullough has brought out repeatedly, I mean, he's lectured on campuses all over the world, all over the United States, hundreds of them. And he's just over and again, he's shocked at the level of ignorance. Here's one final clip from just last year. This is clip 5.
I lecture at colleges and universities a great deal, and I'm astonished at how much these wonderful young people don't know about our country and its story. I had one young lady come up to me after I gave a talk in college in the Midwest, and she said that she wanted to thank me for coming to the campus because until she heard my talk that day, she had no idea that all the original 13 colonies were on the East Coast.
That's David McCullough relating some of his experiences on the lecture circuit there on a university campus. A young lady, and he says, look, it's not the problem with the youth. It's not the fault of the youth. It's the educators. It's the parents. But as he also said, and I played a few clips for you on this point yesterday, I mean, there is a way to fix this. There is a way to fix it. I mean, you can take action yourself, as some of our listeners have done. I've been getting the emails. I read one of them to you yesterday. Another one came in this morning thanking me for the program yesterday, saying this had been on my mind as of late. In fact, today I was making a reading plan for our own little book club for the remainder of the year. I was thinking it would be awesome if the PCG College or some of the trumpet writers produced a recommended reading list. I know various books have been quoted or referenced in trumpet and Royal Vision articles and on KPCG shows over the years, and I'm wishing I would have written all of those down as I came across them. Perhaps a list has been compiled, and I'm just having trouble finding it on the church's websites. Anyway, she says, I think it would be really helpful for those of us who would like to beef up our reading habits. I find it especially difficult to find quality, truthful, unbiased, historical, and biographical books. KPCG's program, Just the Best Literature, has been helpful as well. Don't want to leave them out. I just think a list that people can put on their fridge or on a bulletin board would be really handy. Thanks for all the great programming and for helping us round out our education in preparation for our future. Well, I don't have time to get into it today, but be assured that we are doing what we can to try to send out some suggestions. And she brings up a good point, because with all that we have going on, with as busy as we sometimes are, I mean, it's not just that we need to read. We need to read the very best. We need to, as I said earlier, to be grounded first in the Bible, the literature, the trumpet, the royal vision. And then outside of that, I mean, I think most of us are just going to have to boil it down to as Ernest Dimne says in his book, The Art of Thinking, to just 20 or 30 titles. I mean, if you're younger and you're going through high school or college, you may be ambitious enough to go through more than that. But for some of the older brethren, for some of us who are middle-aged or approaching the older years, 20 or 30 titles, if they're the best, can really change our lives for the better. And more than that, as I said yesterday, if you love it, if you're inspired by it, then you can take it upon yourself to express that love for that knowledge or that truth or that history to your children or your grandchildren. So we'll pull together some titles and pass those along to you later. Suffice it to say, though, William Manchester would be a good place to start. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email us some feedback, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.